This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alan Greganis was a successful writer on his first try. His debut novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, spent 8 months on the New York Times bestseller list. But before he was a writer, he was a kid from Rocky Mount who wanted to be a painter. He studied art at the University of Pennsylvania. But while serving on a naval ship during the Vietnam War, he started to write. His talent for narrative took him to the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop and early success at The New Yorker. And Alan Greganis recently memorialized his mentor, John Cheever. His literary journalism is not only a small part of an admirable output, but he is the author of a small part of this larger output, the author of several books, essays, and novellas. He's currently working on the second in the Falls, North Carolina trilogy that began with The Oldest Living Confederate Widow. Alan Greganis, my guest on the studio today. Welcome to the State of Things.
Good to have you here. Thank you, Frank. It's great to be back. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about this essay you wrote on John Cheever and your relationship with him as a mentor at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You attended the workshop primarily because he taught there. Is that right?
It was just the luck of the draw. It happened to be that the first semester I was there was the semester that he was there in recovery from an embolism and had been shipped out there. 61 years old, but in parlous shape as an alcoholic and as a genius, an amazing writer whose work I had idolized. And I couldn't believe my good fortune in winding up in his class.
What was your sense of sort of meeting him at that point in his career? There's always this question about whether their best days are behind them. And then what's your relationship with these guys while they're still breathing?
Well, I was lucky. I knew him for the last 9 years of his life. And he had a beautiful sort of phoenix transformation. He had was sort of been written off as a viable writer. And then he published his novel Falconer and was on Newsweek and Time again. And showed us, you know, how daily loyalty to this craft that we practice does, in fact, win out in the end. It was very powerful and moving to love the work, to meet the man, to come to really respect and love the man, and to see him rewarded at the end of his life.
Would you read for us some of the passage from this essay that you wrote on Cheever?
That's right. In 1973, on my first day at the Writers' Workshop, the secretary read from her list, "Go to room 210 for Cheever. To read Cheever. To meet Cheever, he's your teacher, son. The old guy's alive and right upstairs, at least he was a few minutes ago. But hurry." I felt as elated as scared. Wouldn't this be like learning to sail a skiff from Melville in one of his rare but amazing good moods? We peeked into Cheever's classroom. He was seated cross-legged on a blonde oak desk and looked like a Noel Coward leprechaun. Black and white striped Brooks Brothers shirt, unpressed khakis. John Cheever wore size 6 Weejuns. "You know, I've always wanted to write that, for its interior rhymes, for its being factual, for its snappy attempt at sounding both as smart and clear as well as a John Cheever sentence. So yeah, John Cheever wore size 6 Weejuns." Though he was only 61, due to being a lifelong chain smoker drinker, fresh from intensive care, the guy looked 80, and I, at 25, studying this battered idol, felt too smooth, half-formed. He'd just suffered an embolism back east, and after promising his family otherwise, he understood he could not stop drinking. So he'd been banished from his home. Cheever found himself guest writer booby prize at the top bidding grad program. I entered his classroom last, nodding. He thoroughly checked out my fashionable pleated pants and all that those implied and contained. Introducing himself to us kids, he showed old-world deference. Cheever's courtesy struck me as heartbreaking. He treated us like this room's celebrities. Such eagerness to amuse and be amused, such readiness to become hopeful or at least distracted. He'd already written most of his immortal prose, and just this mortal husk seemed left. John had once been actor handsome, the juvenile lead, but backdraft nicotine and the erosions of scotch had left him floating in their wake, a scratched stick. Still, he emitted an aristocratic soulfulness familiar to Southerners who forever equate distinction with lost causes.
Hmm. Alan Gurganis, what was it that you most admired about John Cheever's writing?
I loved the work's clarity, its lyricism that was hard-earned and not easy. He's able to write, and I use the present tense because that's the miracle of literature, isn't it, Frank? He's been dead these 25 years, and the work is still got dew all over it. He could write about sunlight and water and make you feel like a baby at the beach for the first time. And it was an odd paradox that he seemed to be a very despairing person in many ways. His journals are the darkest journals that you can conceive of. He was essentially a gay man who in the 40s determined to be a straight man and to have the beautiful wife and the three handsome children. And that division, along with his alcoholism and his miserable childhood, which is like something out of Dickens, made for a very dark and compromised person, but a person who was eager to, as I say, be distracted, to be elated, to be amused, to be alive to the world. And there was nobody more fun to walk around the world with. I mean, he was always getting us involved in sandlot football games, which I found at 25 extremely embarrassing to be playing with 18-year-old boys, and he was 61, and I was 25, and I was in my fashionable tweeds, and here we were rolling around in the leaves. And it was magical. It was embarrassing, and it was troubling, and it was like being with the father that one wishes one had had instead of the distracted businessman that mine was.
But you were a bit of a distraction for Cheever, as it turns out.
Well, I think he saw in me at 25, in my innate capacities, latent capacities as a writer, and my innate and not so latent homosexuality, an emblem of the person that he wished he might have become had he had the benefit of being born when I was in 1947. And I think it was there was some mutual recognition and attraction. I was attracted to his prose, and he was attracted to my prose and more. And it was a time when sexual harassment was not even a phrase. He had his class meetings with all his students in his hotel room with an open bottle of scotch and one of those giant water glasses that you're supposed to use to brush your teeth, but he filled it up to the brim with scotch. And he was an equal opportunity seducer. He just tried to make passes at almost anybody who would walk in the room, including the maids. So I can't feel that I was singled out.
Right.
But I had the wisdom of youth, and I understood that that was not a direction I wanted to go. It was just not feasible. All I wanted was to learn what he knew about writing.
But there's a sort of an interesting dynamic here, it seems to me, and a tension. Number one, it's sort of what to do about this professor, this mentor who has an interest in me. But also your recognition, and I'm not sure you had it at the time, that here's a man who's trying to break out of the closet one way or another. So there's this personal dynamic within him that you might end up playing a role in. All the while, he's somebody you admire as a writer.
I think what he hoped for at 61 was to right the wrongs of the past and to find a handsome, talented kid that he could move to New York with and suddenly announce to the world that, guess what? His work is actually suffused with references to an attraction for men, but it took a long hindsight to see that. But I was just beginning my life. I did not want to be Mrs. anybody. And I saw that the combination of the alcoholism and the regret and the intensity with which he wanted to make up for lost time would prevent him from getting what he actually wanted. So we managed to salvage a real friendship. And he was an extraordinary mentor to me. He, without knowing it, as you suggested in the introduction, he sent my first story to The New Yorker secretly, and the editor of The New Yorker called me at my $60 a month apartment in Iowa City and said, "This is William Maxwell at The New Yorker, and we would like to publish your story, Minor Heroism." And I said, "Yeah, and I'm Mae West. Who the hell is this?" I almost lost my first and only sale. But he was a kind of emblem. I think we talk about our mentor teachers as if they only teach us what to do.
Right.
I think sometimes the greatest teachers are the ones that teach us what not to do.
Huh. Well, what did he teach you not to do?
He taught me not to hide being a gay man. And I see in the world, Frank, a lot of people who are still hiding, and it's pathetic. It's so sad to go to a church and see a man genuflecting with his wife and six children that you've seen cruising 2 days earlier, especially when he's 75 and can hardly genuflect anymore. The hypocrisy is staggering. And I think it's one reason why gay marriage is just an absolute necessity. To say one group can marry and one can't is to deny people who need the sanction of the legal their rights. And I think it might have helped John and his generation, and I know it would be very helpful to me and mine.
Certainly in your personal life, the idea of repressing that and all of the pain and anxiety that that causes people and the people around them, I don't think anybody can deny that. But I'm going to take a break now and come back and ask you how you think that might have affected, if John Cheever were able to come out his whole life, what effect might that have had on his writing? And we'll have that conversation in a moment as our conversation with Alan Gerganis continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with writer Alan Gerganis, first book in the trilogy about fictional Falls, North Carolina, oldest living Confederate widow tells all. He's currently work on the second book in that trilogy. And, of course, there have been many books in between. But we're talking about your relationship with John Cheever and your thoughts about him as a writer and as a man. And, you know, you said before the break what a horror it is to force people to borrow another identity, right, and to sort of hold them in check and repress who you are. And yet, what effect do you think it might have had on John Cheever's writing to have had that tension? How much of that accounts for the quality of his work?
Well, I think he wrote eloquently about family, often the tension in family. And if there's a flaw in the writing, it's that the wife is always a kind of harridan and a kind of monster. And I think that is a real limitation. You look at a great genius like Tennessee Williams, who's, I think, you know, along with Faulkner, is the wizard of the 20th century of American writing. And his plays were often criticized as being masquerades, that he made men into women and so forth and so on. I've had my work criticized by critics who say, well, what does he know about family? What does he know about marriage? Because being out means that you're a target. And if you just shut up about it, you would have been spared that. But I would like to think that Cheever's work could have been enlarged. There are hints about furtive activity in all the books from the very beginning. But it would be marvelous to, if he'd lived long enough and come along slightly later and could have experienced this powerful lyricism about the male body as well as the secret male body and paying obeisance to a female body somewhat dutifully. It's impossible to know. And whatever the tension was that created the work, thank God it was there, because the work transcends that and incorporates that.
I find it interesting that you as an out gay man have to endure the same criticism as the Pope. Little irony there. I thought I'd throw it your way.
Right.
Let's talk about you growing up in Rocky Mount, because you didn't start out wanting to be a writer. You started out wanting to be a painter. Tell us about growing up in Rocky Mount.
I think I was the luckiest guy in the world in terms of winding up in a North Carolina town of 24,000 at the end of the great age of tobacco, before we knew what it was doing to us, literally. My parents were mildly prosperous. My mother was a school teacher who'd retired to have kids. My father and his family had owned grocery stores in the black and white sections of town all those years. And it was an amazing place because there were talent scouts everywhere. It was a different world, it seems to me, where friends, parents suddenly saw you drawing and said, my God, Alan, can I keep this drawing? I mean, you've got to have a show, baby. You've got to have it. So I wound up at literally the age of 12 having a one-man show at the Art Center and sold about 60% of the things off the wall to citizens for up to $35 and $40. I've had people ask me how much they're worth now, probably $35 or $40. But it was an occasion for celebrating the talents of the young. And one of the advantages of being born in Eastern North Carolina, where towns are 30 to 40 miles apart, is that Wilson, Goldsboro, Kinston, Rocky Mount had to be independent city-states. We had to amuse ourselves. There was no Netflix. There was one or two movie theaters, one for the black folks, one for the white folks. So we learned how to play the piano because we amused each other. We told stories because that's what we had to do of a Sunday afternoon. And we painted pictures because the Gay's Hardware sold art supplies in the corner behind the screws and bolts. And it was a great training ground because art was just another aspect of life. And it didn't seem to me apart from anything else. And my neighbors and friends rewarded me for attempting it.
It's one thing to see it as an amusement, and certainly neighbors and friends may appreciate it. But when did you decide that you could make it a career, and how did your family feel about that?
My father was very concerned that I was making a fatal mistake. I think a lot of people who grew up in the Depression and came through difficult times felt that their first priority was preparing their children to earn a living. It didn't matter if the job was horrible. It didn't matter if you were talented in another direction. In a way, it's like sexuality. You know, it's what we were talking about with Cheever. It's like you grit it out. You have a wife and three children, whether you want them or not. And what misery for the wife. What misery for the children. What misery for the people who have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and drive to RTP to a job they hate. They have my undying sympathy. And I tried to arrange my life so I wouldn't be one of those people. So it was only when I sold the first book and the book was on the Times bestseller list, it was a great luck for me that the first book was the one that really sold, that my father finally said, you know, I was wrong. You know, this is incredible. Of course, he assumed, as I did, that every book was going to sell 2 million copies. But it actually let him get rid of this tension. I now realize that it was a genuine fear. It was not the suppression that it felt like at the time. And I think it takes a long distance to see that sometimes what felt like a malicious act was in fact a loving act based on fear.
When did you decide to switch from painting to writing?
I had only a year at the University of Pennsylvania studying painting, and then foolishly I dropped out of school just to figure out what I wanted to do. I was taking my gap year during something called the Vietnam War. I hadn't been reading newspapers. You have to read the papers to know what's going to happen to your sorry ass. And and I wound up, you know, being essentially tried for draft evasion and sent into the Navy. It was only on the aircraft carrier Yorktown that I discovered there was not an art studio, but there was a library. And I started reading, and I was used to making things. If my hands are busy shaping something, even out of construction paper, I'm a happy camper. So I determined that I could write. You know, I had a perfectly good public school education. And so I began to copy the great writers, write a chapter in the voice of Charles Dickens or Jane Austen. I gave myself assignments, and that's the way it started.
Did you have people read them, or were you your own editor in these?
Mostly I was on my own. There were 4,000 other guys on the ship, but there were not many readers on the ship. But I was doing it to save my soul. I mean, it was really like being in a monastery. I was in my little cell, and writing and looking at the sunset every night, I made myself a promise when I got in that I would climb the stairs to get to the top of the ship and every night look at the ocean at sunset. And I swear to God, it saved my life. I could describe at great length a sunset I saw in the South Pacific that's the most miraculous, heavenly appearance I've ever seen in my life.
How did you keep them from all looking alike? It would seem to me that might be the problem.
Well, I was keeping notes about my life there and about the difficulties and so forth, and also inventing. I mean, that fantasy kept me alive, and that's the beautiful thing about narrative. The word narrative is based on the word naros, meaning to know. So a narrative is a knowing, and one can be pretty stupid and trust the knowing narrative to lead you into a clearing, into some sort of reassurance for yourself. And that got me through.
You know, when I think about your novella, The Practical Heart, this idea of narrative and knowing is very much a part of those characters, particularly in the first two, whose telling and retelling of their own story recontextualizes them and puts them in a whole new light.
It's very moving to know that everybody can tell their own story. It doesn't mean that they can necessarily imagine other stories. But if you trust people at whatever level of education to speak the truth in love, as the Bible tells us, and to witness to what has happened to them and what has not happened, you have an immediate and irresistible subject. And I've been lucky because I've trusted that first-person witness voice and want to tell the stories not just of myself but of the choir. I want to hear from every member of the choir.
Do we know our own story? Do we tell our own story? Or are we obligated in some ways to socialize and start telling the story other people have told us about us?
I've often seen people begin with the accepted story of their lives and then break through. When my mom was in the 1970s, a man came through and did a tea group, a sensitivity training group for a lot of women in her church. And he locked them up in a room and he gave them paper and he said, "I want you to write your obituaries." And it was a very traumatic experience for these women. They were typically, you know, had 40 IQ points on their husbands, better educated, more sophisticated, more compassionate, more democratic as voters. And they suddenly found themselves saying wife of, daughter of, mother to. And out of that group of 12 women, three got divorces on the basis of suddenly discovering that their real identities had been hidden to them, that they started with the official narration and only through this means broke through to some truth about themselves and about their superiority and their dimensions.
It's a remarkable process, don't you think? The idea that we can be living with our story every single day, we know it very well, and it's our story. And you tell it to people, you say it out loud. So to that extent, you hear your own story. And yet, when it hits the page, it suddenly becomes objectified and different in a way that even hearing it when you tell it changes.
It's true. And the resume is one thing, but the resume under pressure is something else. Mm. And that's what fiction can do. Fiction can offer up a crisis that gives a true test to the resume. And an experience like the 1999 flood in Rocky Mount, where we saw, you know, 40% of the town essentially washed away as a kind of prelude to Katrina, showed us who was strong and who was not. And people who lost their collection of snuff boxes went to insane asylums because they couldn't bear not to have the snuff boxes. And other people who had nothing to begin with became heroic and transcendent. So it's a fascinating enterprise.
We'll talk to you some more about your education because you studied with Grace Paley at Sarah Lawrence. And we should point out that Grace Paley is probably a far cry from the characters of your youth at Rocky Mount. She's a Jewish New Yorker, a pacifist, a liberal activist for social justice. What was it like for you to encounter her?
I came to her at exactly the right time. I was a Vietnam veteran of just the kind she liked, because I had seen through the hypocrisy and the pointlessness of that war and all the wars we've fought since, all Bush's sand wars, pointless. And she had counseled draft dodgers, and I wish I had found her before I went into the military, not after. And she welcomed me and welcomed my experience. She was a great force for the good, and in a way a diametrically opposed to John Cheever. I mean, this is the beauty of literature, is their voices from the Lower East Side, their voices from Westchester County. And I learned from each of them. I was one of those students who would do anything to learn from a teacher. I was so hungry by the time I was 21, 22, that I felt extraordinarily fortunate to have found her. And I found her because on the aircraft carrier, some sailor's girlfriend left a Vogue magazine with Grace Paley's story in it. I was so hungry to read anything. I would read matchbooks, you know, whatever. And I read that story and I thought, this is the voice. This is the woman I want to study with. And it somehow happened through the GI Bill.
Do people like that teach you about yourself? Or do, I mean, are there technical skills that you think you've learned from somebody like Grace Paley?
They teach simplicity. They teach trusting your own vision, your own community. They teach you to read aloud a lot, read the work constantly aloud. It's the best editorial process there is. And they give you a kind of community which says yes or no. I mean, that's writing is so isolated and so solitary that we need a community of listeners to tell us honestly whether it works or doesn't.
We've talked about some of your impressive teachers, but you have some impressive students as well, Ann Patchett among them.
That's right. Ann was my 18-year-old freshman at Sarah Lawrence when I was teaching there. And she gives me much too much credit. She was already a writer, a born writer, when she approached the class. I was, I was giving an assignment a week to the students, and they were cranking them out pretty regularly. And Ann came to me and said, I don't want to write a new story every week. I want to write one story. I want to rewrite it every single week. And I want to have something at the end of the semester that I think is perfect. And when I saw how she was rewriting, I thought, well, here's a writer. Writing is rewriting, unfortunately, for most people who imagine writing is something that you swoon, you go into, and suddenly you have a 300-page book. It's endless revision. I rewrite to be reread. And that's what she was doing.
Is it unusual for an 18-year-old to say, I don't want to come up with 30 stories because I'll just rewrite. I'll do a second draft and then we're on to the next one.
She was not potential was there. It was not, she was interested in producing something. And at the end of the year, she won a prize with the story and sold it to the Paris Review and was launched. And this is, you know, preternatural for an 18-year-old. And she's an extraordinarily productive and concentrated writer, and I admire her.
You are famous for being able to reflect the landscape and culture of this place. You talk fondly about Rocky Mount. You did live for a time in New York City. How was that experience for you?
I lived in New York for 12 years, taught at Sarah Lawrence, and lived on the Upper West Side. And I had a great time. I went to New York in part to find an agent and a publisher, and to find friends who are still making beautiful things in dance and film and writing. At a certain point after Widow came out, I found it was too much. You know, be careful what you wish for. You might get it. To be invited to all the parties that you imagine is tedious at a certain point. You suddenly begin to catalog them as party A53B with an element of Z. And that's God's way of telling you to get the hell out of Dodge and to get a garden and to go to a small town and start your life over. And coming back to North Carolina, where the smells were so familiar and the things that I could get to grow in my yard were things that I recognized and remember from childhood, was extraordinarily sort of a reconsecration of my work. And it affirmed that I really wanted to write about people who stayed home. There are people who write only about the people who leave, and it seems to be harder and more, ultimately more interesting to write about the ones who stay, since they are the majority of the people on Earth. You don't have to import drama. You don't have to climb Everest. You just sit in your little house in Rocky Mount by the river, and the river will rise, and you will be on your roof. And then what do you do? That's the real crux, it seems to me, of human experience. You don't have a lot of choices in your life in many ways. You make a decision about a loved one when you're 18, and then you wake up at 80, and there he is in the bed beside you.
Well, you talked about reconstitution and recognition when you came back. Is there a way that everything looked new to you because you'd been away, including these characters who had stayed home?
The scale was new. I brought a Manhattan scale to a town of 5,000 people, and I saw the heroics. I saw the nobility of the enterprise, and we don't need to centralize literature. We need to decentralize it. And it's been a joy to be back. It gets richer all the time.
Talking today to Ellen Gurganis, and our conversation will continue after a short break on The State of Things Do. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today to writer Ellen Gurganis. His debut novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, is considered a classic of American storytelling. Now he's at work on the second in a trilogy of books set in the fictional Falls, North Carolina. You talked about coming back to North Carolina, and now you're living in Hillsboro, where I think per capita there are more writers than any other swatch of earth in the country. What about that density? What's it like to live in that kind of a community for you?
There's a real sense of community, a real sense of connectedness, meaning with writers that we leave each other alone. That's really what writers want. Is I have friends who run a flag up their flagpole when they're visitable, and otherwise the answering machine runs interference. It's such a paradox that, you know, in order to affirm human community, you have to be alone about 8 hours a day. But given that, we support each other, we turn up for each other's book parties, and we promote each other insofar as we can. And there's a real sense of comfort, I think, in living around other people who are doing what you do. This culture can be extremely lonely if you're trying to make art and live by the means of the art. And so it's consoling to be near people whose work one respects.
But it does seem there can be a downside to having that kind of concentration of well-established, accomplished writers. I mean, we know about the tension with the late Doug Marlette, a writer and cartoonist, fellow Hillsboro resident at the time, who had satirized the town and you. And that created some tension and some hard feelings, certainly at the time.
Well, the beauty is that most people in the town aren't like that. They are people who support each other and promote each other. And you know, we run into each other at Weaver Street and talk about things other than our narrative patterning. So I think there's so much more to celebrate than there is to satirize and devastate.
But isn't that the part of the writer's job? If the writer feels that this particular group of people need satirizing, then that's part of the truth that that writer needs to tell.
I think satire comes very low on the scale. The real obligation of an artist is to empathize. And Chekhov says no one must ever be humiliated in life and fiction. And to make humiliation your métier is extremely misguided. It's more in the realm of cartoons than it is in high art. And so it's just a question of emphasis, I think. But one wants to, you know, you open your house to your writer friends and you hope that they're not taking notes to make fun of you. You hope that they're not writing devastating things about you. And when they do, all you can do is what I did, was be silent and have no comment. Because, you know, there it is. Everybody, I believe in the First Amendment, even when they're going after me for being a gay man and for trying to be an honest citizen and for being emotional and out there. When you do that, even now in 2012, Frank, you're taking a huge risk. And you should not have open season on yourself in and out of print for being honestly who you are.
Do writers have a responsibility to talk about politics, to be engaged in the social debate that we're having?
I think so. I think it's essential. Having worked with Grace Paley, I just feel that how people live in their homes is established by the political world. Everything is political when seen properly. And it's an odd time to be trying to tell the truth through fiction, which is itself a lie, because lying seems to be the style. I mean, every time Governor Romney opens his mouth, he's reversed his last position. I was frustrated with President Obama's performance at the debate, but I had to sympathize because you prepare arguing points and everything has been reversed after a year of preparation. So it's very hard to figure out fiction, which is the lie that is the truth, when there's so much artful lying going on.
Is the art of the writer to simply reflect all of that, to say, look, this is how I see it, or do you have a responsibility to say, look, this is the way it should be. I need to persuade you to see this another way and to change the way we're headed, change the direction.
I think it has to come through the characters, and it can't just be a superior mind making marionettes move around the stage. If you're deeply engaged with the characters that you've created, they've created you, and they have their own wills and their own wits, and they lead you. It's a curious fact, and one reason I take so long between books is that I want to give my characters breathing room. I want them to be able to make, in the context of the fiction, the kinds of mistakes that we've all made. We've all fallen in love with the wrong people. We've all taken the wrong job, moved to the wrong town, bought the wrong car. And I think there has to be an element of leisure in the fiction and an element of freedom for the characters.
You are now working on the second in the trilogy, and of course, Widow came out a while ago. Has the second one been percolating the whole time, or did you just recently go back to it?
It has been percolating even before Widow was written, and it's called The Erotic History of a Southern Baptist Church, and it's about 100 years of American history from 1870 to 1970 through looking at this little church in the country outside Falls, North Carolina. It ends up as a prospering, then bankrupt television ministry with healing involved. So I'm trying to talk about the movement from the spirit to media by looking at a 6 or 8 families in this little church. And it's been an incredibly fascinating enterprise. I mean, I'm a cranky old agnostic writing about the Lord's work. And my ultimate finding is that community is our salvation. As you know on the show, I mean, just the variety of expression that you find daily to bring to people. And, you know, when the drowning happens, when the fire happens, who's turning up for you? And who will you turn up for? That's the crucial material that I'm working with, and it's very instructive.
How much of that, you say it was percolating even before Widow, but how much of it in detail and in structure was there, and how much has changed by the success of Widow and the time between the time you've had to think about that book in the meantime?
I think it's ripened. I really do. And I'm facing an exciting time. I have long planting and threshing seasons, and now I'm facing harvest. I have a book of novellas that's coming out next year, next September. And then the novel is percolating, and then the new and collected stories are coming in the year after. I'm like the guy, the farmer who doesn't go to the farmer's market till he has some produce to sell. But it takes a long time. I mean, there are people who write a novel a year. I don't have enough breakthroughs in a year psychically, philosophically, to have a report. I think that's what writing is about. It's not just inventing amusements or entertainments. It's about understanding what it's like to be 65 as opposed to 25. And that kind of progress, that kind of insight, that kind of hard-won knowledge is what one brings to the work. So it's an exciting time for me.
You know, you talk about this harvest period. Is it like farming where you just suddenly drop everything and it's all about the writing now?
Yeah, I have to turn in the novellas on November 1st. So it's pretty much, I went to a wedding yesterday and it has to be an important event.
Well, we're honored, I have to
say
that.
Yeah, no, this is great. This is great. I got up early this morning to get my hours in. But at a certain point, you have to be responsible for every word, and there are tens of thousands of them, and you don't want to repeat anything. And so there is a kind of frantic, like an undergraduate who's finishing his first theme paper.
The novella is fairly rare these days. What attracts you to that form?
I think it's ideal for the way we live now, Frank. Peter Taylor, great short story writer, said a novella is a work that you can pick up after dinner and finish by bedtime. So 60 to 100 pages. And it seems to me that one can ideally achieve in that short length what one can do in a novel if you cut out some of the comic minor characters and tell a kind of truth that's immediate and that coincides with how we live, which is, you know, completely interrupted lives that we volunteer for. I mean, it's so strange. I went to a cabin in the mountains with a friend, and there was effectively no internet, and I found myself going through withdrawal symptoms. I was, I don't know what MacArthur Prize I was expecting was looking for me instead of your phone bill is overdue.
That's right.
But, you know, it's like you feel like you've taken leave of your senses if the devices are not working.
What was it like for you, the early success of Widow? Is that oppressive then to sort of have to live up to that?
There's always an element of, like, can you do it again? Mm-hmm. I was lucky because I was 42 when the book was published. I feel sorriest for people who have that kind of success in their 20s because I see, no naming of names, but I see people who were the darling prodigy of a season or three, and they are just writing the same book over and over again, and that's not what I want to do. There is, in a branding society, there is this impulse to repeat the same pattern, and many publishers want that. This is not like your last book. I don't want to do that. I want to give notes from where I stand now. And as you say, the political situation has changed so radically that the work has to respond to that, if only laterally.
Well, as we've said, you've turned out a lot of terrific work since then. Practical Heart, for me, really stands out as some of the finest writing. And it wasn't received as well. And I wonder how you take that, because it's great writing. It's terrific stuff. And here's this thing that was a wonderful book, a bestseller, and then a play, and then not as much recognition since for some really terrific writing.
Well, you have to think that you're writing a shelf of books, and you can't let any response to a single unit of that shelf slow you down. You've just got to keep writing. And if you do continue, you know, that Samuel Beckett line, I can't go on, I go on. If you do continue, there are incredible rewards, not just in terms of public recognition, which is fickle. We all know that Moby Dick was panned and sold 100 copies. But for personal reasons and for spiritual rewards, this becomes my life's blood. I don't know who I am in the morning until I check in with the work. It's an alternative kind of dreaming. And it's why people who never sell a word and never show anybody else their work have to do it. It becomes a kind of gyroscope that keeps us balanced in this crazy world.
You talked about the importance of politics in your work and how it animates everything you do, even if it doesn't reflect itself directly on the page. And there are surveys that abound that show, particularly young people, say they want nothing to do with politics. I wonder how you feel about that. What do you think that means?
I think that's hiding the head in the sand. I think we're all buffeted by politics, and it's better to be informed and to see this as a spectator sport, if nothing else. I have friends who are completely sports nuts. You know, Butch Davis's firing is like the worst thing that's happened in the human universe ever. It's not. It's not important. What's important is that people are taking your rights to contraceptions away. You know, what's important is, you know, gay rights. What's important is the right of poor children to be fed and taken care of. Those are essential issues. And I always encourage my godchildren, and I have several, to read the newspaper every day as a form of entertainment. And very quickly, they become completely addicted, the way we all are. It used to be that you could go to dinner parties and you would hear perfectly credible people say, I don't keep up with the news, it's too depressing. I haven't heard anybody say that in years. Because they're defending themselves, because they're aware that important rights of ours are being threatened and are about to be usurped. So it's just enlightened self-interest, if nothing else.
I wonder, too, if it isn't sometimes a code that people are using to say, because as you suggested, there's no aspect of our life that isn't political. It's either been designed by a political force or it informs the political process going up the line. So if it isn't a reflection of wanting to find a new way to express yourself and a new way to have an impact on politics, that simply voting and demonstrating and showing up are not the ways we want to tell the system we think it's headed in the wrong direction.
Well, I think there's a very heartening movement in the country. I mean, this fresh food movement, this idea of eating things that were grown, you know, 100 yards from where you live, is an indication of politics being local. I mean, literature is local. Everything starts in the neighborhood. And the only things for me that make sense now are the things that I can do in walking distance of my house. You know, I have a big Halloween open house for free. No causes, no charities, no donations, just for fun. And that's a political act, especially in an election year. I have several Abraham Lincolns and I have the Romneys turning up in costume. So it's going to be fun. I mean, that's and it should be. It should be a kind of celebration. I don't think there's any separation from the emotional and the political. I think if you're really an informed citizen, it's all one big thing.
And do you have the third book in the trilogy percolating as well?
I'm thinking that the third book will be about the bank. The first is Widow, the second is the church, and the third is the bank. I still need a lot of schooling in how banks work. I'm not sure that bankers are the people who will actually tell me that. But
They'll tell you something, but then you're going to have to find
out
how it really
exactly.
works. Yeah. Alan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Alan Gurganis, author of several novels, novellas, and short stories. You can find out more about him and his work at alangurganis.com. Here's how you spell it, AlanGurganus, alangurganis.com. And that's our program for today. You find us at stateofthings.org. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.